Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
It's time now for the Friday Gathering, and this week I'm joined in the studio by Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin West and Minister of State at the Department of Transport, Jack Chambers. Ivana Bacic is Labour leader and TD for Dublin Bay South. Louise Byrne, political correspondent with the Irish Daily Mirror, and Professor Alan Barrett, director of the Economic and Social Research Institute. You're all very welcome. Thank you for coming in today. Now, we had the Taoiseach here yesterday, Leo Varadkar. Jack, he told me several times yesterday he wasn't suggesting that protesters down in Clare at the asylum centre at McGowna House were racist, but he was afraid he was hearing a trope in relation to gender-based violence that brown men are a threat to women, which has no basis in fact. That's what he said. Is that what you think is going on in these protests?
Well, I think there's an element to that, and clearly there's probably a variety of concerns, some which I think the Taoiseach is correct to reject, and others that Minister Joe O'Brien has engaged with around, you know, strengthening communications and trying to provide more information to communities within in Inch and in County Clare and other areas. And it's important we strengthen that engagement, particularly as we scale up the accommodation response and provide that humanitarian response for those that are fleeing.
I
would say it's important to say as well that none of us have a veto on who may live within our communities. And if you look at what we also launched this week, the Community Recognition Fund, €50 million of support to community groups, to volunteers, and to actually support communities that are providing that response. We've 84,000 people living in communities across the country that have moved here and that are integrating in our communities that are being supported.
So you mentioned Joe O'Brien's visit to Clare yesterday, and I just see Cathy Halloran in the newsroom reporting that the roadblocks on the access road, they remain in place. He'd requested that they be removed and he'd come back down in 4 weeks, consult with them again. No more people will be moved into the asylum centre in the intervening period. That clearly hasn't worked now. They say that they remain very upset and let down that there was no consultation with them prior to the arrival of the men at McGowna House. Now, what more can the minister do you think, given that that visit last night doesn't appear to have worked?
Well, look, government will continue to engage and communicate with all communities that are accommodating refugees who've arrived here, and it's disappointing that the barricades haven't been lifted. I think we're talking about really vulnerable people who've come here, and I think if you look at the general response across communities right across the country, there's been a really welcome response for people that have come here, and I think that's the important to re-emphasise that. If you take even parts of County Clare, Listunvar and other places that have provided an incredible response, so I would just ask the communities there in Inch to continue to engage and to to stick with us on this and to try and facilitate that accommodation. Yeah. And we are pressed with accommodation shortages on this.
Yeah,
and with the numbers that are arriving.
And we know that there are about 500 people who need accommodation. Ivana, you were in the Dáil this week asking for the Taoiseach to take a lead on this. Now, I put that to him yesterday and he explained how it is working. It's led by the Department of Integration. All of these other departments are working with them. It's coordinated by the Department of the Taoiseach. That visit last night, did you think that showed that the government is taking a lead on this?
Well, first of all, certainly the Taoiseach has given me a similar response in the Dáil before now when I've called for greater coordination across government. And I know what is being done at government level, and we all accept the immense challenges in particular that the Department of Integration is facing. But what we have not seen from government is that level of coordination across departments. And as I've pointed out, and as has been shown, Claire, when we see all the people who are forced to sleep in tents on the street in my own constituency in and around Mount Street, what we're seeing as a failure of government policy, a failure to provide sufficient accommodation. And, you know, the Department of Integration is shouldering the responsibility. What we need to see is more support from other departments, and more, I suppose, more urgency in securing the large-scale facilities that are required.
But he says that is happening. I mean, are you clear that it's not, or how do you know that it's not?
Well, in Labour, we've been very, very keen to ensure that we are hugely supportive of all attempts and efforts to secure accommodation. And I would absolutely agree when Jack says across the country we've seen an immense welcome and immense generosity and hospitality. And that's why, as I said in the Dáil yesterday, the blockade of roads at Inch is unacceptable. We are better than that. Across the country, we've shown we're better than that. We've shown that enormous welcome. But we do need to see a greater sense of coordination from government. And that's why I've called on the Taoiseach to lead out on this. The sort of response we saw from the state during COVID should now be deployed. In my own constituency, we've large empty facilities sitting there, like Bagot Street Hospital, like Jury's Hotel in Ballsbridge. And that's the sort of accommodation we need to see.
So which department do you think is not pulling its weight?
Well, we know that Roderick O'Gorman's department sought support from all other government departments. There are obvious instances of departments where there is empty accommodation. I've spoken directly with Minister O'Gorman and other ministers about Curragh Camp, for example, in Kildare, about Department of Defence facilities that are sitting empty and that could be repurposed. I know it's challenging, but we do need to ensure there is support across departments for the efforts being made by the Department of Integration on this. I do, and you asked me about Minister Joe O'Brien's visit to Inch. I thought that was very constructive. I thought that's the sort of engagement we need to see.
Didn't
in my
work.
Own constituency, I've engaged with protesters. I've spoken with them, heard their concerns, but it's not acceptable to see roads blocked. It's not acceptable to see the sort of hostility to inward migration. And may I say, Claire, I've utterly condemned the horrific attack in my own constituency in Sandwith Street, the burning out of people's homes, the burning of tents by a small number of sinister far-right activists. That was absolutely outrageous to see.
Can we come back?
And, you know, we do stand in solidarity with those who come here seeking refuge.
Can we come back to that allegation or suspicion that the departments are not working to their full capacity across the board to help the Department of Integration? Jack, what do you say? I saw you shaking your head there as Ivana was saying that.
Yeah, I think the measure of that is the 84,000 people we've accommodated. We've had a phenomenal coordination and cooperation between government departments when you look at the scale of our response over the last 15 months. At the beginning of 2022, we had 8,500 people being accommodated.
And in fairness, and we know those numbers, but we have 500 people now who don't have accommodation. And what Ivana is saying is there are empty facilities out there that are not being used.
But you're pointing to the 500, and I'm saying to give balance to that legitimate question, you need to reflect on the 84,000 that we've actually accommodated. And we've a cabinet committee structure around this, like we had with COVID. And, you know, we've Colin Barracks, for example, that with the Department of Defence has offered. There's a number of other properties being offered as part of that, and they're being refurbished and brought into use by the Department of Integration. And different departments lead on different aspects of the response. So the Department of Justice is responsible for the processing of refugees. We have the Department of Social Protection is providing the welfare response. Department of Health scaling up the healthcare. So different departments are providing and leading in their areas of responsibility. And the Department of Integration are obviously responsible for accommodation. And there is a united front and cooperation across government. There is a concern within government about, obviously, we're all concerned about those that are having to sleep in tents, and that's a genuine concern across the political spectrum. And that's why a few hundred beds are being brought into use in the coming days, which will assist.
Yeah, go ahead, Louise. The departments offering these buildings. I have had ministers and people in different departments name me buildings this week that they have offered months ago, weeks ago, that aren't being used, that weren't seized upon because it was said that it would take too long and, you know, we need stuff in the short term. And there seems to be a kind of a lack of medium-term thinking there. And I know there is an urgency and we need things straight away. But I think the argument from a lot of ministers and a lot of people this week is, well, if you don't look at this in the long to medium term, well, then we're going to face the situation again in a couple of months. So I think there is questions to be asked about why different things have been offered by departments and they've been told, well, we need stuff now, so we'll look at that again at another time when, you know, they could be perfectly good and people could be living in them now if they had been acted upon months ago.
And whose fault is that?
Is that
the Department of Integration saying we can't use that now, so that's going to be off our list and not planning for the medium to long term? Or does the responsibility lie elsewhere?
I think the responsibility lies across the whole government. You know, you could say, well, why isn't the Department of Integration picking up on it? Why are the departments not pushing harder and offering them again and again and again? I think, you know, I don't think you can point the finger and say this is one person's particular fault. It seems to be a lack of cohesion across the cabinet table.
And what have you heard about this alleged lack of support for Roderick O'Gorman. I mean, we've heard persistent rumours now about him feeling as though he's shouldering this burden alone.
Yeah, I mean, that has been said for months and people have been saying that to me for months, that that was kind of the feeling. Now, I think other ministers have been very quick to come out and say, you know, we've done all we can. We are offering these things. But I think, you know, and I heard, and it was widely reported during the week, the tensions did kind of come to a head at Cabinet on Tuesday. It was kind of a feeling that, you know, the Green Party came in to back up their man. Fianna Fáil came in to back up Dara O'Brien. The Taoiseach rode in behind Dara O'Brien then as well. So it kind of felt like there was kind of a feeling amongst the parties that people came in to back up their man and everyone kind of came in ready for an argument.
Alan, you want to go ahead? Yep.
You know, just a quick point. I know we're talking about the issue from the perspective of the politics of it, okay? But the reality, of course, in departments, its officials are grappling with this. I mean, this isn't as much a policy issue. It's a logistical issue, okay? And to refer back to what Jack said, I mean, I think the first thing we want to say is to congratulate the officials who have managed to house extraordinary numbers of people. Officials who've been out in places like City West in high-vis jackets and stuff like that. These are civil servants normally. So there has been an extraordinary effort. And I think, you know, if we talk negatively about the response, we're essentially talking negatively about the civil servants and others who have worked so heroically, I think, to deal with everything. And there are remaining issues. But can I just broaden the discussion ever so slightly, okay, just beyond the logistics? I think why this week has been sort of really, really worrying in terms of the attitude towards migrants is that Ireland over the last sort of 10, 15 years, we've seen this remarkable growth in our migrant population. Okay. And, you know, when I would sort of talk about issues like this at international conferences, one of the great things about Ireland is we absorbed a huge number of people with very, very little evidence until recently of a far right backlash. Mm. Or of a general difficulty. Now, there was always a number of theories as to why that was the case. One was, well, was it the case that because so many Irish people had emigrated themselves or had family members that in some sense we were, you know, well disposed.
We had an understanding.
So that was sort of, that was the positive interpretation of the reaction. The more negative one was most of our migrants were white Christians. Okay, especially the Eastern Europeans. And I think what's really disturbing this week, okay, and I don't want to sort of move into the territory of labelling people as racist or anything like that, but you began with, you know, the section but sort of talking about this possibility that these are people who are sort of slightly different and look different and in some ways were threatening. I just think we're on the threshold of tipping into a very, very dangerous territory here. And I think in a sense that that's just the bigger picture that I really do worry about.
Mm-hmm. And what can be done about that?
Well, I think you're back to, I mean, firstly, I think the sort of the positive comments by a lot of politicians, okay, and again, like people like Ivana beside me here talking about like things like Roblox being utterly unacceptable, calling out behaviour for what it is. Again, you know, Jack again sort of talking positively about so many of the good things that have happened. But I think we need to look into our hearts again, okay, and start asking questions, you know, again, like, why would anybody think that you're more likely to be assaulted by a male of colour relative, you know, to a white Irish male?
Mm-hmm. Well, the protesters, when they've been interviewed, said that they've said very clearly that that's not their issue, that if there were any large group of single men, as they put it, moving into a place like this, an isolated place, that they would be fearful. That's what they say.
And that's possibly true, but I think we have to question, you know, sort of more broadly, is there something deeper and more sinister going on here? Mm-hmm. And I think then as a society, we have to make sure that we speak in defence of these individuals and just make it clear that racism and those sort of negative attitudes are simply not acceptable.
One of the people who John Cook interviewed, one of the protesters, spoke about no phone coverage in the area, no street lamps. They have absolutely nothing there in terms of services, and that forms part of their real concerns.
Yeah, but we all know, and again, there's sort of two sides of the coin. I mean, on the one hand, we're talking about migrants sleeping rough in the streets. Okay, I do think being housed somewhere where there's no mobile phone coverage is still preferable to being on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so everybody knows that a hotel in the middle of nowhere is not ideal. But we are in a tremendously difficult situation. Back to the officials who are trying to grapple with this, you would like to think over time that people can be rehoused in places that are more suitable. But in the short term, surely that is better.
Yeah, I mean, that woman that I mentioned there, when she was speaking to John, she said, she was in tears, and she said, we're being branded as racist rednecks, and that's not who we are.
Well, maybe so, but I think people who start putting up blockades open themselves to certain accusations, because that's behaviour which is simply unacceptable.
And I do think it comes back to, we've heard Minister Harris say yesterday there's been 125 anti-asylum protests in Dublin alone, and he is very much of the opinion that there are groups travelling and that there's kind of people going into communities and kind of hijacking what are legitimate concerns, like no mobile phone coverage, things like that. So I think, you know, it's a broader question for government, is how do they stop these people travelling? How do they get a hold on that element that seems to be growing and seems to be going into communities? And I think they were in your constituency last week,
they
Ivana.
Were. And as I said, Louise, I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. It was a small number of far-right activists, from everything we've heard on the ground, that were involved in orchestrating that horrific attack on tents just off Mount Street and around Sandwich Street. And that deserves utter condemnation. But I think the key issue here is to ensure that there is a positive messaging, again, a coordination message coming from government and from all of us. All of us in public office have to be responsible and respectful. But we do need to emphasise the enormous positive contribution of inward migration here. This week we've called, for example, for the for a change in the policy to ensure that those who come here seeking asylum are entitled to work 3 months after arrival rather than the current 6 months, because we're conscious there are huge labour shortages across the country in every sector, healthcare, hospitality, retail and so on. And yet we have a really enormous group of people who just want, who want to work. I mean, anyone I've met on Mount Street, they talk to me about how passionate they are about making a contribution. They want to see their applications processed so they can work. One said to me, "We may be in a tent here," he said, "but it's better than a prison camp in Russia." So, you know, that's, as Alan says, you know, while we can be critical of some aspects of accommodation that's offered, our key responsibility in international law, and as the High Court has told the government here in domestic law too, our key responsibility is to ensure accommodation of those who come here seeking refuge. But we also, I think, have to recognise the enormous positive contribution and the skills and the talent that they bring, as the people bring, so, as a pool of labour.
So just to finish on that, do you think that that's something the government should consider, Jack, that people who are seeking asylum would be allowed to work after 3 months rather than six?
Well, we have. So when it comes to the majority of people have arrived here from Ukraine and they are able to work, and we've...
Yeah, but asylum seekers, that's a different scheme.
But we have. We've done that when it comes to... I mean, there's a wider piece there on how we, in terms of the processing of refugees.
Up applications,
and
then,
there's a wider consideration in terms of the overall process. And I would say from probably the most diverse constituency in the country, in Dublin West, when I go to local schools, we've 50 plus nationalities, all who are making a phenomenal contribution to Ireland and are integrating so well together in sport.
It's fantastic to see.
In sport, in workplace and within communities. And it's trying to maybe speak to communities that maybe haven't had that experience of the enormous contribution that makes and will make.
I wanted to move on to something else that happened this week. In fact, yesterday, the Taoiseach and Minister for Defence, Micheál Martin, speaking about this upcoming consultative forum on international policy, which is going to discuss Ireland's foreign policy. And he spoke about the triple lock mechanism and whether it was fit for purpose anymore. Ivan, I'm going to come to you first on this. Do you accept that now in a changed world, and we've been discussing some of the issues that affect that, we need to reassess our security policy?
Well, I'm a very passionate advocate for our military neutrality and for the triple lock and for its continuance. I was alarmed to hear the Taoiseach question whether the triple lock is fit for purpose. I think it served us really well. The triple lock being, of course, there must be a mandate from the United Nations, either Security Council or General Assembly in the first place for the deployment of forces abroad. And secondly, of course, Cabinet approval. And thirdly, Dáil approval. So, you know, I believe that mechanism has served us very well, that our neutrality policy has really enhanced Ireland's reputation on the international stage. And of course, we're not alone in the EU, because we have Austria, we have Malta also. But I would say this, you know, in the face of the brutal Russian invasion of Ukraine just over a year ago, of course, we're not politically neutral. Military neutrality is not the same as impotence. It's not the same as just being a bystander. And, you know, I think all political parties have recognised that we have a responsibility to support Ukraine in every way we can, apart from militarily. And that's why it's been so welcome to see such huge generosity here for those who've come fleeing the war in Ukraine, and to see the support that's gone to Ukraine that is non-military.
And you don't think that circumstance has changed how we should view the triple lock, given that Russia or China could prevent us, couldn't they, from sending peacekeeping troops?
Well, I think there's a misunderstanding about that, because it doesn't just require a Security Council mandate. The UN could, for example, authorise deployment through a General Assembly assembly mandate where you don't have the same veto issue. And of course, the Security Council, where Russia does have a veto, is deeply is imperfect, you know, but it is the best available we have. We might think of the UN intervention, for example, to enable shipments of grain from Ukraine, and even in the teeth of the brutal war. You know, we do have to abide by the principles of multilateralism and international law that is represented by the United Nations, imperfect though it is. And, you know, I suppose, Claire, we might recall that all through the Cold War, when there was a very, very serious concern about Russia, as there is now, mm-hmm. you know, that the Security Council remained as it currently is. Let's look at UN reform by all means. And, you know, I'm very much open, as we are in Labour, to the discussion at the forum the Taoiseach is convening.
Discussion, but no change, it sounds,
well,
from what
no,
you're saying.
No, but it's not just a binary. I mean, I staunchly defend our military neutrality. But let's look at, for example, our defence spending. And I think that's a key issue. We do need to recognise the reality of cyber attacks, of all sorts of issues around our national security. Mm. You know, we do need to ensure we have adequate defence spending ourselves.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that we abandon or undermine or weaken
the triple lock should stay.
It should stay.
So on that, Alan, do you agree that we need to radically increase what we're spending on defence, but perhaps we need to be careful when we're talking about other security measures?
Yeah, well, let me start, and before I say anything, let me say I speak as a citizen rather than an expert, okay, because I really know nothing about this area. But where I kind of come at it is in the following way. I think a discussion and a reappraisal of this entire area is really, really important. And while, you know, Ivana talks passionately about neutrality, and of course I understand that, I think for a lot of people, we've never really understood precisely what neutrality meant. And just to give a couple of examples, I mean, we discovered recently like this long-standing arrangement with the Royal Air Force.
Yeah.
You know, so we weren't perhaps quite as neutral as we actually thought. I think there's been a degree of comfort that we at one level, our sort of geographic location has meant invasion is unlikely. And I think implicitly we always thought that we were under some sort of British and American umbrella. And I think there was almost like a sort of for a lot of people, a blind eye was turned to neutrality issues because we had that comfort. I think one of the big game changers now, of course, modern warfare is not about invading so much. It's about cyber attacks and a whole range of other things. So all of a sudden, I think our geographic location is not going to give us comfort. If anything, given our, you know, because we're such a centre of data centres and all American technological investment, we're probably actually a quite a vulnerable state rather than any, which would suggest that maybe we do need to increase their expenditure. But this is the really important thing. I cannot imagine Ireland on its own being able to defend ourselves against the sort of, be it Chinese, Russian, North Korean cyber attacks if they really, really came at us. So the question does arise on a practical level, do we need to align ourselves with other people? And just the last thing I'll say in advance, I mean, Ivana sort of talked, and again, I get it, this idea, well, say when Ukraine happens, of course we're not neutral and of course we're not.
Not politically neutral.
Yes, but it raises the question, rather than looking at things on a case-by-case basis, do we need to, in advance of something bad happening, such as Russia invading Ukraine, say we will align ourselves with states who share our sort of interests and values?
But we're already doing that. In Article 29 of our Constitution, we've done that. We've signed up through the United Nations and through the EU. So I suppose, Alan, you could say we're very much part of that international network or grouping under a whole number of different headings of democratic states that have signed up to the principles of international law. So I think that's already there, and it's very clearly enshrined in Article 29 as well.
Okay, Jack, quick word from you on this and then I'm going to move on.
Yeah, look, there's no doubt Ireland is continuing to uphold our, you know, multilateral system and, you know, around international law, human rights, equality and respect. But I think it is important that we deepen political and public understanding about the international security environment and we have that conversation. There's no prejudging the outcome and no hidden agenda. But when you think that Russia can effectively veto Ireland sending troops in peacekeeping missions.
Well, Ivana doesn't agree with that.
There's been no new peacekeeping mission approved by the UN Security Council since 2014. And I think we have to re-examine our whole security policy in that context. And as Alan said, if you look at the digital architecture of the state, how globally connected Ireland is in terms of technology, data centres, energy and telecommunications, we have to make sure we have a fit for purpose and robust defence architecture that can defend ourselves and indeed the investment that is concentrated in Ireland. And I think this is a wide conversation where all perspectives will be listened to, and there's no outcome that's been preconceived. It's up to, you know, that the recommendations discussions and the engagement to happen.
Okay.
And let's see where it evolves.
Now, I'm glad that Tánaiste is going to be looking to Switzerland and experts from Switzerland to tell us, to talk to us about positive neutrality.
When we started that conversation about neutrality, you said you're not an expert, Alan. You are an expert on this next topic that I'm going to talk about, because when...
But to disappoint you now, Claire, but
when the Taoiseach was here yesterday, he was talking about taxation. We were asking him about whether he was still interested in that 30% tax rate that he mooted some time ago. And he said his priority is that middle-income people wouldn't be paying the higher rate of tax. He's agnostic about how we get there. Now, is it a good idea, in your view, to look at lowering the amount of tax paid by people, the bulk of people in the middle?
I don't know if it's a good idea or not. I mean, ultimately, these things are a sort of a decision for government. You know, there's no right or wrong answer here about how you structure things. I mean, certainly what makes the Irish tax system quite unusual is the extent to which we do two things. We exclude a lot of lower income people from tax. Okay, they're quite unusual, the extent to which we do that. But then we ask relatively lower income people to pay tax at the higher rate. So we certainly have an unusual tax structure. So if you're to benchmark it against others, you can sort of see the argument that the Taoiseach is making. But this is just one of those sort of classic decisions that governments have to make.
We were talking about the corporation tax, you know, the big corporation tax that we're expecting to see up to 2026. And he sees no reason why that can't continue at a level close to where it will be at for 2026. He was talking about selling energy. We're looking at wind and solar, and that could be the next boom time for us. But we can't rely on that.
I think that is the point. He might be right. There are circumstances under which you can see that the windfall, as it's described, could continue. But that's a high risk strategy. And I think modern governance, be it in terms of sort of organisations, businesses, and indeed the state, you run all of these operations with an eye to risk and not creating an over-reliance. So I think the strategy the government is talking about, I mean, this idea of sort of creating the sovereign wealth fund or whatever, possibly to look at the aging costs, I think that's actually a very, very sensible way to do things.
See,
and if there's an upside, there's an upside.
Louise, this is political, isn't it? Because this government has a limited amount of time to get the big bang out there for taxpayers.
Absolutely. And I think, like, Fine Gael sources have said to me that this is the reason they went into this government, was to stop middle income earners paying a lot of tax. And they are determined that they're going to get that higher rate of tax up to 50%. Now, the big question is that something Michael McGrath is going to agree to? And do they have other priorities? And because it's really Fine Gael pushing that. And Fianna Fáil don't seem as keen. They didn't seem as keen on the whole 30%. Now, I know the Taoiseach was trying to distance himself, saying it wasn't his idea yesterday, even though I think he was the one that said it first. That is Fine Gael's priority, and they do want to get that done. And it is political, and I think everything now is being done with an eye on the next election, whatever that's going to be. There's kind of, I think there's a belief within Fine Gael that it's going to happen kind of immediately in the aftermath of the 2025 budget, so kind of in around October, November 2024. So they are very concentrated on budget, and they are very concentrated on those middle income earners who make up predominantly their voter base.
You don't like the 30% tax rate, Jack, do you?
Well, I think we do. In the next, obviously, the next tax package, there will have to be relief for low middle income earners. If they have wage increases or bonuses, paying that at the upper rate is difficult for many people who are facing the cost of living challenge. And certainly from a Fianna Fáil perspective, we absolutely want to remove some of the burden, and there will be an income tax package at the next.
But a 30% rate?
I think there's different ways you can address taxation overall, but I think a progressive change in the next budget would be to help ease the burden for many workers that are faced with a high tax environment.
Believe it or not, we're out of time. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming in, and thank you at home for listening. You can catch up on anything you might have missed on the RTE Radio app. Today's programme was produced by Rachel Graham. The series producer is Alistair McConnell. Emma Cawley was our researcher. Our broadcast coordinator is Louise Kerr-Ross. Kieran Cullen was on sound. It's over to Louise.
Thank you.